Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So over the weekend, there was a little confab at the Harold Washington Library on youth violence. Since we've come to learn that in the first quarter of 2022, doing a little stop, look, and listen here, 57% of the carjacking perpetrators have been juveniles. And, of course, carjackings are up significantly this first quarter of 2022 over 2021. And 2021 was a record year.
Yeah, the fun continues for the little kids.
Here's what Mayor Triple Threat had to say as to the root cause.
There are too many young people in this room who do not feel loved. Too many. And we've got to change that around if we're going to change around the trajectory of their lives.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
So the kids who attended this summit on youth violence don't feel loved.
Well, was that what you said? I mean, because she said that before. I remember during the pandemic at one of her news conference, and, you know, we were asking her, like, there's a lot of kids that aren't in school and they're carjacked. She's like, we just need to love them more. She always said, like, that's the solution to the violence, is we need to let them know that we love them. Even after they carjack us, we're supposed to, what, turn around and hug them, Lori?
No, I think she's suggesting that they're unloved and it leads them down this dark road to violence and other destructive activities. Okay. So let's just say for the sake of argument that kids probably dropped off by their parents to attend this youth summit or involved in some other youth program, that they were actually at this gang summit and they are not the perpetrators of violent crime. But these kids are telling you they're unloved. Okay. Let me just stipulate for the sake of argument that that's the case, that that is a root or at least a significant underlying problem. So what do we do about it? What do you want to do about it? Wait, I know. Let me guess.
Wait, what?
60 years of our experiment in replacing mom and dad with government hasn't worked because it hasn't been big enough. And so what we need to do is have a city agency of love. Need to have bureaucrats in charge with loving unloved children. Let's identify them and associate and assign a worker per child to make sure they're getting their requisite daily dose of love. Is that the solution? Because what that is politicians can't. That's to sound compassionate while tolerating, if not outright pursuing, barbaric public policy. That's what Triple Threat is doing at that summit, as she's been doing really predating her term as mayor and including her time on that police reform board that was her springboard to mayor. Isn't that right? Or is there some other solution I'm missing? I believe it was Secretary of Education Bill Bennett back in the day when he was in that post under Reagan, who said the government has never raised a child and it never will. But that's not going to stop the left from trying. We know that. But to what effect? 60 years of this? 60 years of seeing the family structure assaulted by government at every level? And most devastatingly in the black community? And now we come to listening to politicians like Triple Threat tell us about unloved kids on the West or South sides where most of the violence is occurring. That's the proximate cause of it. Okay, well, so what do you want to do about it? Just preach love
hug a carjacker? Well, I mean, what is she? What is she suggesting?
Well, while you're preaching love, what are you doing to provide for public safety? Because these unloved kids, as you term them, are doing some horrific things to people that are otherwise law-abiding. You know, like the head of your Chicago film office, who got beaten into the intensive care unit over the weekend while going home, trying to get home to, I think, Hyde Park. A 51-year-old black man, does he deserve some love from the mayor and the city? So what's it going to be with all this love talk, all this gooiness, like you're on the set of some ghastly daytime talk show? It's so disrespectful, but everybody just falls for the, oh, of course, you know, give peace a chance. Make love, not war. Another refrigerator magnet bromide you get from these hack politicians who've undermined your quality of life, who've undermined your public safety, who've driven your friends and family members from this city and state altogether. But it's all about the love with Triple Threat, isn't it? It's really despicable.
She's, at this point, she's desperate. She doesn't know what else to do.
Jim, Crown Point.
It's very simple. You need both parents in the home. You need your children to learn discipline. You need them to learn respect. They have got to be on lockdown every minute of their day. You've got to know where they are 24/7.
Okay. Right. Yeah. But it's the same deal. So now all the horses are out of the barn, and you're telling me how you're going to manage them in the barn. And the question is, now what do we do?
I have no idea.
Thanks for the call. Exactly. And this is not to jump on Jim from Crown Point, but I don't want to hear what an ideal world looks like. I know what it looks like. I want to hear what our approach should be, because on the one hand, you have those promoting a platonic society through government like Triple Threat. And on the other hand, you have people making excuses for those who've abrogated their parental responsibilities and just responsibilities as citizens, responsibilities as human beings. And you want to tell me that public policy, some law, is going to change that? So what's the illegitimacy rate in the black community? 75%?
75%, yeah.
What's it in the Latino community? Upwards of 60. What's it in the white community? Close to half. You're going to pass a law? What's that law say? Pat in Lockport.
Yeah, you know, Dan, I totally agree with your statement that the government cannot replace parents. Whatever happened to the concept that the father is the head of the home and the mother is the heart? If you truly love, quote unquote, these kids, that family is not going to be on government sustenance. That child is going to be rooted in rules, regulations, and a lot of love. You will get your butt out of bed and go to school. You will do your homework. You will be at the dinner table every night. I will check your homework. And if you screw up, number one, you better watch your backside. And number two, you're going to make restitution or correction wherever it is necessary. Any poor kid that is running around feeling that nobody really gives a damn where they are or who they're with is not loved. And you know what? That is true.
Thanks for the call, Pat. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
So with Triple Threat and these politicians like her, these hustlers, race hustlers, identitarian hustlers like her do, is they say, I'm about love and the police are about hate. Because the first order of business, I'm sorry to say, you've unleashed this parade of horribles on the law abiding. And the first order of business is to remove the violent from the society of decent people.
Right.
And here's a little montage of what Lori Lightfoot had to say, just some of the highlights over the last 6 years from her time on the Police Accountability Board to her time as mayor about police.
It is essential that the police department take responsibility for the way in which it's policed and the way in which it has, in many instances, alienated people of color, particularly African Americans in this city.
We live in a city that is traumatized by a long history of police violence and misconduct.
We can't rely upon the police to provide public safety.
Really?
Wow.
So who's it going to be then? Who's it going to be? You, Triple Threat?
I know she's meeting with Superintendent Brown today and other city leaders to provide an update on public safety. That should be interesting.
I assume that means
1:30.
I assume that means her detail, some 70 strong, as I understand it. Keith Thornton is a 911 dispatcher, black gentleman, who's running for state rep now.
Yeah.
We played his some of his comments before. He's talked because he knows about this as 911 dispatcher about the deployment of police in the city. He was on Fox and Friends over the weekend, had this to say about Triple Threat.
Well, we've been feeling since she's been in office that, hey, crime is here. And with these bills that they've sponsored and different things of that nature with these politicians, now she has her own secret little patrol on top of her regular detail patrolling her house. 71, I think, is the number. And actually, she wants more officers on top of that. I've heard that there's SWAT officers at her house on and off as well.
Well, that could be for other reasons.
71 cops
part
of her 24/7 detail.
Mm-hmm. Remember, she was the one that said, I'll pay for my own security. I'll take, you know, I don't want to pull any resources away from the people of Chicago. Remember during her campaign?
Mm-hmm.
More lies.
I'll tell you, there are some members of the community that are taking her charge to love a little harder.
Yeah.
Love a little bit more. This wonderful story that's a perfect commentary on Chicago. You know, at least these guys are trying to make it a fair fight. After robbing a man on a CTA train in the Loop, a group of armed robbers gave the victim a switchblade and recommended he use it to prevent becoming a robbery victim the next time.
What, are you sure that's not from the Babylon Bee?
Yeah, I wish.
That's really happened?
This is according to Cook County prosecutors.
Oh, my God.
They robbed a guy in the CTA, left him with a switchblade, and said, hey, next time, defend yourself. You know, at least,
hey,
look.
Hey, buddy, put a little effort in when we're robbing you. We want a little pushback, buddy.
No, at least not for them, but for the next
guy.
At least
they're
trying to, you know, make it sporting. We know that the police aren't going to defend you. We know that the politicians don't want you to be able to defend yourself in Chicago. So, you know, here's something where you could try to Bernie Getz the next guys who try to rob you or do rob you on the CTA.
Coming
John
up,
John and Crown Point.
Yeah, why don't we start holding the parents accountable, you know, then they can love the hell out of their children. When I was a kid, if I broke the law, my dad would sure as hell love the hell out of me.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, the problem is if you can find the parents.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, look at Adam Toledo. I mean, they're coming out. Oh, the one-year anniversary of his death. His mom didn't even know he was gone. She didn't even know he was dead for 3 days. Police had to go to her house to let her know. She just thought he was at a friend's house, sleeping over.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The battle lines drawn in Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis doesn't back down when he stakes out a position because invariably the position he takes on a particular issue has been well considered and thus is properly articulated as well as institutionalized. As is the case with this legislation, this parental rights legislation, which prohibits gender ideology curricula in pre-K through third grade.
And in case you don't notice, what the left calls the Don't Say Gay bill.
So Disney went very quickly from a position of neutrality initially to open advocacy. And you wonder, well, how did that happen so quickly? What's going on at Disney? And what should the response be? Well, there's been a rhetorical response from DeSantis to this point. But as Disney continues to beat the drum, DeSantis and other Florida legislators, Florida Republican legislators, have raised the specter of Disney's unique arrangement in Florida, where under Florida law, they govern themselves. This 40-acre parcel on which Disney's compound sits was essentially chartered such that Disney has its own police and fire and effectively acts as a municipality.
Wow.
Well, that special charter could be revoked. It was enacted into law some six decades ago. It's not, was not handed down on tablets. So the legislature could rescind this charter, this special privilege, as DeSantis calls it, and then put Disney's existence in terms of their ability to finance operations squarely on that private corporation's shoulders. Or if they saw fit, maybe they could provide some sort of taxpayer subsidy. I don't know how popular that would be. And I'm sure Disney recognizes that as well. DeSantis saying that I don't see any reason why a private corporation should have such a special deal with state government. That's exactly what one of the problems is in America today. It's big corporations that are rent seekers that use their political power to get special deals at the expense of other people.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
There was a very good article, op-ed, over at Quillette by a Disney Imagineer, as they're called. His name is Ethan Clay, and he describes the institutional capture at Disney. And he goes through sort of the Disney mantra, the Ten Commandments and the four keys that have guided Disney's corporate culture for the last 65 years. He writes, suddenly this is all changing. The last couple of years have brought COVID, lockdowns, the summer of 2020, and the doctrines of critical theory and its various permutations to the Disney Corporation. And by the way, just to take a step back for a second, I think we've made this explicit, but perhaps it requires repeating. When we're talking about this LGBTQIA alphabet soup ideology, this queer ideology, this queer theory, as it's called, this is twinned with critical race theory. Queer theory and critical race theory are two prongs of the same identitarian attack. And I'm not sure people are receiving it as such, but they need to. All the time we spend on critical race theory curriculum in the schools and these fights that have presented themselves in elections like last year in Virginia and to some extent in New Jersey as well. Well, all of this and thus the parental rights legislation that DeSantis signed into law, this queer theory, this sexual identitarianism is partnered with the race identitarianism. It's all part of a larger cultural Marxist gambit to indoctrinate kids to transform America into something it really never was and never should be. And you have to understand it in that context. It's not just about, it's not even mainly about adults who want to use children as sexual playthings, as disgusting as that is, and there's a part of that. But the bigger play is indoctrination, which you see going on all the time, and which many teachers, thanks to TikTok and YouTube and their own arrogance or ignorance or the combination of the two, have said explicitly, I'm in the classroom to train social activists, political activists. That's the point here.
And here in Illinois, I mean, the House passed the Too Young to Test bill. So from pre-K to second grade, they're too young to test. That bill's headed to J.B. Pritzker's desk. But I kept thinking about it. I mean, the kids pre-K to second grade should not be tested in reading and math, but educators should be able to teach them about sex.
Well, you know, the priority is the indoctrination piece. That's right. So back to Mr. Clay, the Imagineer from Disney, and his memo from inside the house here. He talks about how things have changed in just the last 2 years. The short answer is institutional capture. The term once belonged to economic theory as regulatory capture, you know, where the entity being regulated by the government captures the agency and bends it to its will. Okay. Well, that's the same thing, only the goal is not to change regulatory policy, but to turn the business itself into a mouthpiece for an ideology. Disney has been rotting from the inside for quite some time, but the speed with which this public transformation took place is truly breathtaking. Florida was the final straw. And he goes through how quickly it happened. On March 2nd, their company president, Josh D'Amaro, recorded the first company-wide communication on the matter, in which he spoke about a space for all, inclusion for all, voices to be heard, the need to talk freely. 5 days later, March 7th, Disney CEO Bob Chapek sent out a company-wide email in which he said that he had met with a small group of Disney LGBTQ plus leaders to discuss the legislation, revealed that a common theme was disappointment that the company had not issued a public statement condemning the legislation. But he said at the time, you'll recall, the best way for Disney to respond is through the content that it produces. And so he essentially took a position of neutrality. On March 8th, the next day, bill passed by the legislature, and a flurry of rumors emerged about more meetings and demands from Disney's DEI department, you know, the Diversity, Inclusion, Equity department, ubiquitous in corporate America, ubiquitous in K through 12 education, ubiquitous in America generally now, because we let them have the run of the field, as we're wont to do as common sense conservatives. And then we wake up one day and say, what happened? March 9th, during the company's shareholder meeting, he announced, Chapek, the CEO, you'd be meeting directly with DeSantis to oppose the bill. So you start to see the move off of neutrality. March 11th. So starting on March 2nd to March 11th, 9 days. And, you know, these big corporations usually move at the speed of an aircraft carrier, not a motorboat. This is exceedingly fast to do a 180, which is, of course, what happened. But it's nice to document this, as this insider has good perspective. March 11th, another company-wide email. Thank you to all who have reached out to me to share your pain, frustration, sadness over the company's response to the Florida legislation. It's clear this is not just an issue about a bill in Florida, but another challenge to basic human rights. And he apologized. I'm sorry. You needed me to be a stronger ally in the fight for equal rights, and I let you down. I'm sorry. As Ethan Clay writes, this Disney Imagineer, in less than 2 weeks' time, the company had moved from principal neutrality to open advocacy. And this is what's happening company-wide at Disney, and it has been happening for two years, as he said, Florida being the last straw. Just as once venerable organizations like the ACLU have meekly surrendered to capture, Disney has allowed itself to become just another domino as DEI ideology, DEI is what they call it, DEI I think is a better acronym, just reverse two of the features there. DEI ideology continues its long march through the institutions. And he also talks about how Disney employees are not monolithic in their view on this. Some of the younger employees that have no family are more sympathetic, whereas he writes older cast members with families, particularly those in salaried management creative roles, favor parental rights and tend to support the legislation. The problem is not at the top. As Chris Rufo presented to us some videos from inside the empire, if you will, this is what some of the leadership at Disney had to say at some of these company-wide meetings that precipitated their about-face in less than 2 weeks. Disney's corporate president, Carrie Burke.
I'm here as a mother of two queer children, actually, one transgender child and one pansexual child, and also as a leader. And that was the thing that really got me, because I have heard so much from so many of my colleagues over the course of the last couple of weeks, in open forums and through emails and phone conversations. And, I feel a responsibility to speak, not just for myself, but for them.
For her pansexual child and her trans child. Mm-hmm. pansexual. She has a child who describes him or herself, I don't know if it's a boy or girl, and apparently neither does she, as attracted to all genders and gender identities, which is what pansexual means.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out what that means back here.
Yeah, that's part of the LGBTQIA+. LaTanya Ravenow, she's an executive producer for Disney programming.
It's like, I love Disney's content. I grew up watching, you know, all of the classics. They have been a huge, like, informative part of my life. But at the same time, like, I worked at small studios most of my career, and I'd heard, you know, hear whispers. Like, I'd heard things like, oh, you know, they won't let you show this at a Disney show. And I'm like, okay. So I was a little, like, sus when I started. But then my experience was bafflingly the opposite of what I had heard on my little pocket of, like, you know, proud family Disney TVA. The showrunners were super welcoming. Meredith Roberts and, like, our leadership over there has been so welcoming to, like, my, like, not at all secret gay agenda. And so, like, I feel like I felt like it was, I mean, like, maybe it was that way in the past, but I guess, like, something must have happened in the last, like they are turning it around, they're going hard. And then all that, like, momentum that I felt, like, that sense of, I don't have to be afraid to, like, let's have these two characters kiss, let's in the background, this, like, I was just wherever I could, just basically adding queerness to, like, if you see anything queer in the show, I'm proud of them. But, like, I just was like, no one would stop me, and no one was trying to stop me.
Yeah, my not-so-secret gay agenda. I'll just add queerness wherever I can shoehorn it in, which is what Carrie Burke had to say, essentially, too, talking about we need to have more leads that are LGBTQIA+, you know, so the whole compliment. More pansexual leads, not enough pansexual lead characters in Disney stories. 50% minority, we have to do quotas with respect to characters. And I don't care if a character is black, white, or other. But the point is counting, because it's their not-so-secret identitarian agenda. That's the point, which is completely lost on the identitarians.
So when you go to the park, you get a lot more. I know a family that canceled their trip to Disney World because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think others are going to follow.
It's no different than this teacher, substitute teacher, who was handing out wristbands, rainbow wristbands, to students at an Ohio school district. Jay Bauman is his name. He distributed LGBTQ plus bracelets to high school students. And he suggested that his firing from the school district appeared to be tied directly to me being gay. No, of course, it was tied directly to him being a political activist in the classroom and attempting to impose his views and his advocacy on the students in his charge. And so that's what Disney is going to do. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. These people hate their customers, these businesses. They're terrible people. That despised Keith Olbermann used to have a segment called The Worst People in the World, as he wasn't the one that should have been running something like that. They don't care about your children. They hate your children. And you can just tell, Dan, by the way they're fighting back against us, they never read anything that's in the bill. And they have to be fought at every leg of this. They're winning, it seems. Hopefully I'm wrong, Dan, but it seems like they're winning.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Here's what President Trump had to say at the rally he had over the weekend in Washington Township in Michigan.
The American people will not sit idly by and allow our children to be indoctrinated, segregated, and mutilated by the lunatic left. Not going to stand for it.
We're going to find out. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Should we care if the left cannibalizes the left at an institution that has abdicated its responsibility, like Fenwick High School? Should we care? Fenwick High School is Catholic in name only. It's a ceremonial Catholic school. It's gone. It's not based in the catechism anymore. It's based on social justice politics because it's been taken over by basically liberation theologians, much like Loyola Academy in Wilmette has, much like my alma mater in Bennett Academy in Lyle has. These Catholic schools have no substantive Catholic identity. It's just something they call themselves.
It's a place where the principal was running around telling people to put their masks up. And it's a place where they had a fundraiser where parents didn't have to wear masks and got to have fun and have a party. But yet they denied kids homecoming dance. Remember that?
Yes, of course. Yeah. It's run by COVID nuts. Peter Groom is the principal there.
Yep.
They're also identitarian nuts. Father Richard Petticord is a priest, but he's a promoter of homosexuality and LGBTQ identitarian ideology. As I said, they're not interested in Catholicism. They're interested in their leftist politics. That's what these schools have become. So it's sad. Can you still get a good education? Does it still have status? Sure, in some circles. It's a shadow of its former self, is Fenwick, is Bennett, is Loyola. So, the people who went there and send their kids there, they can continue to delude themselves, some of them, into believing that the school is the same school they went to when they were a teenager. But that's what it is delusion. But that's not the question. The question is, I have no interest in Fenwick. I have no respect for the leadership of that school. I have very little respect for most of the parents in that school who have allowed Fenwick to become what it has become. And I would say the same about those other schools I mentioned and so many more. So why should I care if somebody makes a dubious allegation of sexual assault against one of the teachers at Fenwick?
Who's still there, by the way.
Why should I care? I'll tell you why I should care. Because standards don't mean anything if you're not willing to apply them to people you don't like. This is what the left purposely, I think, and consistently gets wrong. The First Amendment is only for people I agree with. No, we wouldn't be much of a First Amendment then. Wouldn't be much of a protection if it was only for those in agreement with those in charge. Hardly a universal right. And so the same thing goes here. If somebody is being falsely accused, then I should rally to that person, number one, as a Christian. And I know Fenwick doesn't know anything about Christianity anymore, but it's a standard for a Christian as well as just a standard for somebody who wants to be intellectually consistent and live in a free society. And so we turn to this case of Helen Quinn Passon. That's her name. I don't know if that's how it's been reported in some of the Chicago press outlets that have picked this up. In fact, I know it hasn't been reported that way. That's how she presents herself, Helen Quinn Passon, using her mother's maiden name for the hyphenated portion of the name. And she took to YouTube to talk about what she says John Quinn, no relation, who is the brother of Pat Quinn, longtime basketball coach at Fenwick. In fact, he's an Illinois Hall of Fame basketball coach there.
Yep.
And longtime teacher, and he still teaches there. She accuses him of sexually assaulting her a decade ago. She's 26 now. This is the setup.
I am here as an absolute last resort. I never wanted to have to talk about this publicly And for people who care about me, my grandparents, young children in my life, to find out about this story in this way. But as a concerned adult who has experience working in schools with children of all ages, I cannot sit by while my abuser still works at Fenwick High School. He has harmed other people, and the school is well aware of his bad actions. I reported it to the police this year and put the school on notice.
Mm-hmm. So what did she report to the police? Well, in this video, she goes through two incidents that were also included in an email she sent to Peter Groom, the principal, and Richard Petticord, Father Richard, the president of the university. I mean, the president of the high school, I should say. These are the two incidents that she characterizes as abuse, sexual assault.
Two incidents stand out as extra disturbing to me. In March 2013, I was a member of the Italian Club, and I was the last student to leave our St. Joseph's table after school event in the school basement. As I left, I saw Mr. Quinn walking down the hallway towards me. We were alone in the hallway, and he did the same thing to me. Wrapped his arm around me, put his cheek on mine, and asked about my love life while looking me up and down and making noises that sounded like he was growling. I was terrified and thought something much worse was going to happen. I managed to get away after multiple times trying to pull out of his tight grasp, only to be pulled back in by him. After this, I told my parents, and my mom asked if I wanted to report it to the school, and I said I didn't know. I had no idea this was illegal, and I thought I was overreacting to how bad it made me feel. A couple of days later, Mr. Quinn was no longer at school because he'd been suspended for slapping my classmate across the face. I thought he'd indeed be fired. So I decided I didn't want to deal with it. After a few weeks later, Mr. Quinn returned and the harassment continued. Towards the very end of our senior year, my friend and I signed out of our lunch period to go to the library to get extra studying done for the end of the year, and Mr. Quinn happened to be there. I sat in a table and I used a computer, so we were separate during the period. While I was on the computer, Mr. Quinn came again and did his usual. It was even more apparent that he was rubbing his lips on my cheek this time. As usual, I was frozen and terrified and just went back to work after. But at the end of the period, she came rushing over to me very concerned because she had seen it and asked, "Did he kiss you?" I never told anyone other than my parents about what he had been doing to me. So this was the first time I told a friend.
And the effects on those two incidents, the effects that were visited upon her, according to Helen Quinn Passon.
He's notorious for putting his arm around students. And every year, without a doubt, the students who played Mr. Quinn in the Bonawa talent show did the arm thing. It's his signature move. And it's illegal. I don't know if he ever did it sexually to anyone else, but I'm deeply concerned that he still works there and I want him out of the school.
And the investigation that the school conducted per her missive to the principal and the school president?
When I was 16, 17, and 18, I didn't anticipate the dangerous effects of what he did to me. But as a 26-year-old woman, I can definitively say that when he did these things to me as a teen, it made me believe that I was inherently bad and promiscuous. It was grooming and it traumatized me. I was sure he'd be fired for his long list of bad behavior, without me having to tell this story again and again and be re-traumatized each time. He needs to be fired, and I'm committed to seeing that through. So after I sent that email to Fenwick, Peter Groom actually responded in a few days, which I really appreciated, but then a really disappointing investigation unfollowed, which was just immensely triggering to me.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I mean, first of all, the teacher in question, which mainstream media will not name him, but we all know who he is. He's the former governor's brother. Hello. He's been placed on administrative leave now because of this. But I think more should happen to him because of follow-up. Then the next day, she got so many emails from people that she put out a 24-minute YouTube reading emails from current students, from teachers who supported her, and even a father whose daughter goes to school there.
I was there before the school was co-ed, and he liked to do the same thing to guys there. He tried with me in his history class, and I grabbed and wrist locked him in the middle of American history and told him to keep his hands off me. I had friends that played basketball for him that would tell me they stopped showering after practice because he would sit and pretend to grade work and watch the team showering. He's a disgusting individual. I want to let you know that I stand with you against this man and anyone who let him continue there.
All right, did they give him, you know, keep him there because he was a successful coach? Did they keep him there because his brother was governor?
So you believe her?
I believe her, and I believe all these other people that wrote in emails and teachers that wrote in emails saying that this kind of behavior is continuing.
Mm-hmm. Anything that you've heard from Ms. Helen Quinn Passon that makes you skeptical of her story? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Do you believe her?
Let me ask you a question. She said she told her parents at the time. She also says later in the video that parents didn't think that it was much of anything. You heard her say, my mom asked me if I wanted to report it. I said I didn't know. Her parents knew about it,
and they
according
kept her
to her,
school.
And they said they did what?
They didn't take her out of school.
It wasn't reported for 10 years. It turns out that the rush to judgment on these things. I know we're supposed to take take women at their word. You can't ask questions if an accusation is made. Sorry, I'm not in that camp. It turns out that Ms. Helen Quinn Passon is an aspiring documentarian. After graduating from Medill at Northwestern, speaking of triggering, she has a site that she posted. She talks about being a documentarian, feminist documentary filmmaker. Who's made artistic videos on the hashtag MeToo movement, reported on Black Lives Matter rallies. She's got the full complement of a wokeism in her resume as she presents it. Her father is the CEO of Radio Flyer, the wagon company, you know, Bob Passon. Her father, I guess, his grandfather, great-grandfather started the company. Huge donor to the left, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama.
So socialist liberals can't get molested by their teachers?
Is that what I said?
No, but it's like you're alluding to it. Your character assassination.
Is that character assassination telling?
Which
part of it, what I said, is inaccurate?
Well, what are you getting to that she's not telling?
I'll get to it when I get to it.
Okay.
I'm giving some context here. I know you've already made your judgment because you just rush into things emotionally. I'm actually a little skeptical when I hear words like traumatize and re-traumatize and triggering. I find out she's a feminist, self-described feminist documentarian who's focused on the Me Too movement. Is it Is it worthwhile to ask questions about some of these accusers? The guy has been there for a long time. And again, Pat, I don't know John Quinn. I have no use for Pat Quinn. I don't have no use for the school. Nothing in it for me. But you'll pardon me if I take a bit of a jaundiced eye to looking at accusations coming out of social justice incubators by social justice activists who want street cred for their political career or their film career, as the case may be. What did she say exactly? What did you hear the accuser that you played say? Oh, he did it to boys, too. The story on John Quinn, as I understand it, from talking to parents at Fenwick, who have kids at Fenwick, past and present, is that he's sort of this avuncular guy. He's been around forever. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, he's handsy and grabby, and he's a hugger and so on and so forth. Not my speed. I'm not that way.
But we all had teachers like that in high school. That were the huggers, that were the kissers, that were, it's gross to say, but it's true. I don't think they have them there anymore, but that's, you know, people can identify with what she's saying, I think.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, is it possible that there is more to this than Helen Quinn Passon is providing, and that this trauma that she suffered is convenient a decade later when she has career upside to promote it? Fenwick does this investigation, and Quinn Passon, who, by the way, got lawyers from Time's Up.
Well, she went through seven lawyers. She finally, you know, the seventh lawyer finally took her case.
Why did she go through seven lawyers?
Because I don't think the other lawyers thought she had a case, or they would have taken it, and people should know that, too.
Oh, so Fenwick High School, social justice political activists for social justice political activism, they don't take this seriously. Her parents didn't press her to report it. They didn't do anything. She's gone through seven lawyers until she got to Time's Up, an advocacy organization. That's not curious at all to you.
And then it was deemed a battery, which the statute of limitations has already run out.
She agreed to be interviewed for the school's investigation.
And then didn't show up, right, for the interview?
Then she declined at first, then she agreed, then she refused per the advice and counsel of her Time's Up provided lawyers. And her closing thought in her first video?
And if anyone needs advice or assistance or emotional support in reporting something like this in any way, please reach out to me. I'm beyond happy to share my experience with you, give you advice, anything I can do.
I mean, you can take that two ways. In a light most favorable to her is she's trying to pay it forward. In a light least favorable to her, she's trying to aggrandize herself.
Or, you know, she really cares about the kids that are still at Fenwick because she saw him as an active threat. But
well, that's what I just said. Right. She's either paying it forward or she's trying to aggrandize herself and put herself in the role of victim who becomes advocate, who becomes heroine of the Me Too Time's Up movement.
I'd love to hear from somebody who had him as a teacher. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Dave in St. Charles.
Hi, I was a student at Fenwick as well as my two older brothers, and I had two nieces that went through there as well. Everything you're saying, Dan, about the school, its current state is spot on. I've been upset with them for years regarding that. But my brothers and I, we all had Mr. Quinn for history. I became a history teacher myself because of his class. He is a phenomenal teacher, and like a lot of Catholic school teachers right now, I feel that he's just a man out of time. You know, the school environment has changed. He's been there for 40 years. I watched that girl's video over the weekend. You brought up a good point about the seven lawyers and whatnot, but she also brought up the point as well, and I think you kind of touched on it, that during the variety shows every year, they would do an imitation of him, and he would do the arm thing of pulling it around. When I heard about this, I remarked, and I said, he did that to me. He did that to everybody. So for her to personalize this like he was grooming her, that was just Mr. Quinn. And you know what? It'll be a sad day when they lose him, because he is the if Fenwick used to be the soul of that school, teachers like him are the heart.
Thanks for the call, Dave. The use of all the buzzwords in her letter and then recounting her letter and adding to it in that video, in addition to the other contextual factors. So what do we have here? Do we have leftist hypocrisy? It's a leftist institution. They should be completely aligned with whatever a woman says, regardless of how credible the story is. It is to be believed, Christine Blasey Ford, but they're not. So you pick it. It's leftist hypocrisy at Fenwick, or it's somebody who has their own agenda, and it's another case of the left cannibalizing the left.
Got a text message. Her chosen words, Dan and Amy. Story sounds like she's trying to groom, direct the audience instead of being an honest portrayal.
Chris on 55.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. As I told you, screener, she sounded exactly like the accuser of Kavanaugh with scratchy voice and rehearsed shtick.
Thanks for the call, Chris. I mean, before I found out all of this background information on her and her family, I didn't buy it. I didn't buy it. And by the way, what she's actually accusing him of is
kissing her in the face.
She didn't really say kissy, put, you know, cheek to cheek or whatever. Being, like I said, the avuncular sort of handsy guy who's a little bit too familiar with everybody, but that's just his personality. And from a bygone era, I mean, you know, I had basketball coaches that, you know, put their arm around me too, or whatever, you know, rub you on the head or pat you on the ass. Is that triggering and traumatizing? Was I being ridiculous? That's why the context is so important. That's why the particulars are so important. Can't just take somebody at their word, particularly when you look at all of these other details.
Oh, yeah. And she claims, like, he had eyes on me when I got there because, you know, joked around with me that we had the same last name. And
yeah,
I'm just telling you what she said in her first.
Well, I understand. Though. Right. So it's to work backwards and construct a story that paints everything as part of a nefarious plot to groom her for his, sexual fulfillment, which is essentially what she's insinuating. And I don't think she really makes a very strong case. Ignacio in Spring Grove.
Yeah, you there, guys? Hey, listen.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had something of a weird situation about 10 years ago. I was a regional director doing a bid of a cleaning company for a hospital. I was in the hospital. Of course, I had to look at every room, every operating room, every restroom, including the ladies' room. I went in. Nobody was in there. I blocked the door open. I looked around. I figured out all the fixtures. I walked out. As I'm walking out, a nurse comes walking in. I said, oh, excuse me. I said, don't worry. I'm finished. I was just taking measurements of the building. About an hour later, I get a phone call saying that the young lady said she was sexually harassed. Now, this would have ended my career. It would have ended my marriage. It would have ended everything in my life at that point. Fortunately, I challenged it. I asked for her boss. I asked for HR. I asked for everyone. She ended up apologizing. Thankfully, she was scared because she said, I only made it up because I didn't have anything exciting to tell my friend. So while there are people who are genuinely victims out there, there are people who are genuinely trying to fabricate stories for attention. And I'm not saying this is the case, but that's something that always has to be considered.
Absolutely.
And we're familiar with that.
How many race hoax stories have we talked about, starting with Jussie Smollett, but a lot lesser profile ones? You can't have a sexual harassment hoax story? I think you can.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy in our Campus Beat segment, latest edition. I guess we don't have theme music anymore.
No, we do. Oh, there it is. Ask and you shall receive, Dan.
Because they got the beat, the Campus Beat, the Campus Beat. Yeah, the Campus Beat.
Oberlin College and Gibson's Bakery. You may remember this case. We actually had one of the principals from Gibson's Bakery on after this occurred. In November of 2016, three black Oberlin students, or this is small liberal arts school in Ohio, I'll have more to say about Oberlin in a minute.
Robin Mead went there.
Well, one of their illustrious grads. Three black Oberlin students walked into Gibson's Bakery, which is a small family-owned bakery and convenience store that's been run by the Gibson family for 130 years.
Wow.
Had a long-standing affiliation with the college, supplying students with daily breakfast fare. On that day in November of 2016, the son of the owner, Alan Gibson, who we spoke with, saw one of the students use a fake ID to purchase booze and then shoplift a bottle of wine.
Okay.
When he confronted, the students fled the store, chased by Gibson in an attempt to apprehend him until police could arrive. The other two students immediately became involved. All three were arrested.
As they should be, because they committed a crime.
Well, that's not what Oberlin students or Oberlin University brass thought about it. That exchange, altercation, led to a student protest with hundreds of people gathered outside the bakery. They were distributing flyers that accused the bakery of having a history of racial profiling and discrimination. All of a sudden, after 130 years, now it was discovered that they were white supremacists. Right. College administrators joined the students in handing out the flyer to patrons of the bakery and passersby during the protest.
Of course they did. We need more muscle over here.
Among the administrators who participated in the protest, Meredith Romando, the dean of students, she passed out a flyer to a reporter as well as a large stack of flyers to students to distribute. She was part of this mob action against Gibson's Bakery. Well, Gibson's didn't take it lying down. They sued. And they won a jury award of $11 million in compensatory damages, $33 million in punitive damages, and $6.3 million in attorney's fees.
Wow.
I hope it bankrupts the university. I doubt it will, but I hope it at least puts a dent in Oberlin's ability to operate. Well, just last week, a unanimous three-judge panel of the Ohio Court of Appeals handed down the decision. Of course, Oberlin appealed that judgment. And the three-judge panel unanimously upheld the jury's finding that the college was liable for libel, IIED, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and intentional interference with a business relationship. Almost $50 million that Oberlin College will now have to pay the Gibson family. Good. As I said, I don't think I can make a stronger statement when I say I hope it bankrupts the college, and I hope it sends shockwaves through higher education in this country.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And sadly, the baker's owners, David Gibson and Allison Gibson, they died. Allison Gibson died in February and David Gibson died in November of 2019.
Well, the family got justice.
Yep.
For those who may not remember, because I remember this, because this was a story out of Oberlin College when I was an undergrad 100 years ago. This is a school that was on the forefront of the totalitarian campus culture. Decades ago, you may remember, Oberlin College made news for requiring male students to ask for and to receive explicit consent from female students at each stage of romantic intimacy. In other words, you're two undergrads, boy and girl, you're out on a date or whatever at a frat party, whatever. May I hold your hand? May I kiss you? And so on and so forth. And if you didn't get explicit consent, or if the woman said she didn't give explicit consent or explicit consent wasn't sought, then you were labeled a predator and or expelled from campus. The beginning of the guilty until proven innocent campus culture. And how many cases have we talked about of these Star Chamber Title IX proceedings, as well as Mattress Girl in the Ivy League, and so many stories, the Virginia rape hoax, so many stories where the accusation is all you need, building off of what we were just talking about, Fenwick. And then regardless of the evidence, sans any application of common sense, you can get busy destroying lives. The same way Oberlin College tried to destroy a 130-year-old business in town.
And where are they even going to have that money? Where does that money even come from to pay that lawsuit? I mean, might they have to shut down? Or they take it out of their endowment?
Oberlin is a prima facie case as to why even center-left academics with integrity, and that is a small group, like Jonathan Haidt at NYU, are setting up curricula outside of the university setting. Heterodox Academy in Jonathan Haidt's case. I mean, this doesn't stop what's happening on college campuses, it won't. But it does strike a blow, and it does provide some promise that at least in some places there will be consequences to joining the mob to make reckless accusations that are without foundation, particularly in the direction of identity, because that's how you whip people, particularly these social justice addled undergrads, into a frenzy. And if we were wrong, you know, mistakes will be made. You got to have, you know, some eggs will be broken in pursuit of creating a better, more equitable world. The kind of stuff that you see. And by the way, consequences, just consequences. Jonathan Perkins, UCLA, he's their race and equity officer. Of course he is. Jonathan Perkins tweeted out last week upon hearing of Clarence Thomas's illness. No one wants to openly admit we all hope Clarence Thomas dies. Whatever you need to tell yourselves, this whole rule we're not to wish ill on people is silly. Uncle Thomas is a sexist token who's committed himself to making us all share in he and his treasonous wife's misery. Jonathan Perkins, University of Virginia law grad. He is bad. He's literally endangered lives of countless of this country's vulnerable populations. His wife's legit treason to this country are also reason enough for an impeachment investigation. Thomas, he can go. Oh, by the way, you'll be unsurprised to learn that Jonathan Perkins, the race and equity czar at UCLA, committed a race hoax when he was a University of Virginia law student.
Oh, what did he do?
More than a decade ago. Accused police of profiling him. Made up a story out of whole cloth.
Oh, nice.
So, consequences at Oberlin, but very few other places. But at least at Oberlin, at least for one business, you can share the story. Because it's not going to get reported, because the Gibson Family Bakery, this 130-year-old business that served the Oberlin community and students for generations through generations of Gibsons, they're not sympathetic to the larger press corps. So there's not going to be any profile on the reporting of this case. They're too busy. The victimizers are too busy claiming victim status for themselves, which is why it's important to distribute this story. It's important that everybody knows this story. At University of Illinois, U of I will soon require all faculty members to submit a diversity statement to be considered for a tenure position or a promotion. The provost announcing the change, saying, in order to meet the goals of its current strategic plan, DIE, the university must, quote, catalyze innovation and discovery, find novel and proactive ways to educate students from all walks of life and develop ever deeper connections with the public we serve. Uh-huh. And this is also something that is now standard operating procedure at the post-secondary level. I mean, it just comes back to this conversation that we continue to have about the value of higher education, wherever, what value there is, particularly and hopefully as more and more employers tear down that threshold of a BA to be considered for employment. But at least you have Oberlin, the reckoning at Oberlin, $50 million worth of reckoning at Oberlin. That's something.
It sends Frank, a message.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
This country is self-immolating like a Buddhist monk. Or a really good metaphor is we're kind of like Imperial China. They used to have a very rigorous examination system for their bureaucrats. And then that fell apart, just like our university system is falling apart. Imperial China had a really big drug problem. It was opium. We have meth. They used to have a unifying religion to a certain extent, Confucianism or unifying philosophy, Confucianism. We used to have Judeo-Christian values. They had eunuchs and mandarins who were kind of like our C-suite corporate CEOs and the media and the other corrupt influences in our society. We're just falling apart. That's what's happening to our country, and this is just evidence of that. The colleges that, I mean, I can't, the rigor in these colleges today, it's grade school. I mean, I don't even know if you should go to college. I really don't.
Well, right.
Amen to that.
Well, it's just a one big campaign seminar by leftist political activists from pre-K through post-secondary. And look,
and the fact that you have to write a diversity statement to be a tenured professor at University of Illinois, please.
Your contributions to diversity.
Oy.
I mean, this is worth it. And by the way, this is all, you know, this is a public university. So we're being forced to underwrite this at U of I. It's one thing at Oberlin, private school, but of course,
right,
most of these private schools also receive some federal grant funding and so forth. So we're still being forced to subsidize them at some level. But for a land grant university charged with educating and providing deference to the population that underwrites it, like Illinois families. I mean, it's not bad enough that you have so many Chinese nationals taking the spots of Illinois students of Chinese extraction or any other extraction, Illinois land grant university, because they pay full freight. So there's more money in it for U of I. That's an abrogation of their charter. But, you know, shoulder shrug. There's no die concern there. Because there's cash to be had so they can continue their political work under the guise of intellectual rigor. But I tell you, these cases, if you don't stand up for yourself, like the Gibson family did in Ohio, and if you don't stand up for others, even others you don't like, when the mob comes for them, as we were talking about with John Quinn at Fenwick, then I think Frank is right. Then the self-immolation will continue. Then we will collectively burn this to the ground through overt action or through inaction. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I didn't watch, so I was relying on Twitter to inform me as to whether or not Kanye slapped Pete Davidson last night at the Grammys or some other pillow fight broke out.
He didn't.
Oh, he didn't.
The biggest
okay.
drama was Doe's Cat or was something?
Dojo Cat.
Dojo? What is it? Dojo? Young people, help us out. Doja Cat. Yes, thank you, Justin. Doja Cat was in the washroom when they announced her as a winner of a Grammy. That's the biggest exciting thing that happened there.
Well, that's not the biggest exciting thing. Although I guess your point is that maybe we're tiring of Zelensky's omnipresence in American media. I mean, is he going to have the final or the championship game interview at halftime tonight to Kansas, North Carolina? Is there going to be some sort of Zelensky message during a timeout tonight? Zelensky was piped in to the Grammys. Yep. There was rumors he was going to be piped into the Oscars, too. Those didn't materialize.
Yeah, and Sean Penn was going to burn his melt his Oscar if they didn't let Zelensky speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't do it, Dan, just in case you're wondering. Yeah.
Well, I thought he gifted that to Hugo Chavez back in the day. But, okay, I'm glad he kept it. Zelensky did make it to the Grammys, and by video, of course, and this is what he said.
The world, what's more opposite to music? The silence of ruined cities and killed people. Our children draw swooping rockets, not shooting stars. Over 400 children have been injured and 153 children died, and we'll never see them drawing. Our parents are happy to wake up in the morning in bomb shelters, but alive. Our loved ones don't know if we will be together again. The world doesn't let us choose who survives and who stays in internal silence. Our musicians wear body armor instead of tuxedo. They sing to their wounded in hospitals, even to those who can't hear them, but the music will break through anyway. We defend our freedom to live, to love, to sound. On our land, we are fighting Russia, which brings horrible silence with its bombs, the death silence. Feel the silence with your music. Feel it today to tell our story. Tell the truth about the war on your social networks, on TV. Support us in any way you can, any but not silence. And then peace will come. To all our cities, the war is destroying. Chernihiv, Kharkiv, Volnovakha, Mariupol, and others, they are legends already, but I have a dream of them living and free, free, like you on the Grammy stage.
And then he introduced John Legend.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, he did, because John Legend had some composition based on poems from Ukrainian nationals. Yeah.
That translator sounds sinister. The Wizard of Oz.
So, again, opposed to the Russian invasion, opposed to Putin's atrocity, opposed to a KGB thug who's lorded over Russia for the past two decades, opposed to tyrants everywhere. Okay. I didn't see Enes Kanter Freedom get his star turn at the Grammys to make his case against the Chinese communist tyrants who have committed genocide against Uyghur Muslims in that country. Why not? It's just getting a little theatrical for my tastes. And again, it's not to minimize the atrocities that that Putin has committed or the strategic interests that America has in preventing Putin's revanchism. But it's just getting a little theatrical to me, for me. And by the way, let's just take a step back and try to provide some context here. Before we all get whipped up, continue to get whipped up into emotion-driven frenzy here. Cheryl Atkison, great investigative reporter, her Full Measure program, she sat down with our friend VDH, Victor Davis Hanson, great classicist and historian, and talked a little bit about Ukraine and Russia. And in the run-up to her conversation with VDH, she reminded us a little bit about Ukraine's role in American politics over the last several years.
Alexandra Chalupa was a Ukrainian-American operative for the Democratic National Committee who'd worked for the Clinton administration. According to Politico, she led a massive push of the Trump-Russia collusion story in 2016, coordinating with the Ukrainian embassy in Washington, the Hillary for President campaign, members of Congress, and reporters at outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Yahoo News. The FBI partnered with Ukraine's Anti-Corruption Bureau, producing allegations against Trump's campaign chief published in the New York Times. Multiple Ukrainian officials took to the media against Trump and his team, Ukraine's Minister of Internal Affairs, a former prime minister, the ambassador to the U.S., and a member of parliament called Trump an even bigger danger to the U.S. than terrorism and said that he challenged the very values of the free world.
That was Ukraine in 2016 under Zelensky. And then Ukraine in the run-up to impeachment 1.0. You haven't forgotten, have you?
After Trump was elected, Ukraine played a large role in his first impeachment. Multiple State Department officials would later admit they defied his policy directives on Ukraine because they disagreed with him. Democrats launched impeachment proceedings largely on the word of a White House Ukraine expert, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. Vindman accused Trump of improperly threatening to hold back aid to Ukraine to force an investigation of Hunter Biden's business dealings. Vindman was so close with certain factions in Ukraine, he admitted they repeatedly tried to hire him.
And to his credit, Zelensky downplayed that allegation and the subsequent phone conversation he had with Trump when this all blew up. But here's VDH on Ukraine and Vindman.
The general impression is that Ukraine supporters within the United States have taken an inordinately political role. And so what I'm getting at is, I know it's a weak state, but it was also corrupt and it interfered within the internal politics of the United States. And that created a lot of ill will here.
Mm-hmm. And VDH on Russia, particularly Russia as in the Russian army when they're engaged in expeditions like the current one.
I think it's a stereotype, but it said it's very foolish if you're a Swedish king or Napoleon or Hitler to go into Russia because Russian soldiers fight fanatically on their home ground. But by the same token, the Russian army is not expeditionary. It does not do well outside the confines of Russia, historically.
And he reminds us of the Russians getting repelled by the Poles in 1922, by the Finns in 1939, and of course, much later, by the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So why is it that we should do more than provide the means for Ukrainians to defend themselves and repel the Russians from Ukraine, as other countries have repelled the Russians in such during such invasions throughout the last 100 years? For more on that question, please be joined by Dakota Wood, who served America for 2 decades in the U.S. Marine Corps. He's a senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota Wood, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So what about, Zelensky started with Bret Baier on Friday night and he ended with the Grammys on Sunday night. I appreciate that he is doing what he thinks he needs to do to communicate to the West, to rally support, to generate whatever resources he can secure. But to my question, is there any reason that we should do more than we've done with the combination of sanctions and provisions for Ukraine?
Well, if you're getting at introducing U.S. forces, then no, we shouldn't do that. But certainly continuing the stream of munitions and anti-platform weapons is what Ukraine needs. And we should continue with that. You know, you'd mentioned the Russians in Afghanistan with Victor Davis Hanson commenting on that as well. The Mujahideen, the Afghans, were able to defeat the Russians because of the Soviets, because the U.S. provided stingers. So it's kind of a, rolling back into history there. So, yeah, I think if you want to keep Russia contained in some way, and Ukrainians are fighting very hard to do that, to push back their gains in Ukraine. They can only maintain that effort if they have a continuing flow of munitions.
With respect to what Zelensky had to say about what he needs in order to negotiate an armistice with the Russians, he emphasized this need for security arrangements with the West. it sounds almost like he wants a NATO guarantee without formally being a NATO member. Is that judicious?
Well, I mean, there was it wasn't a guarantee, but there were assurances given when the Soviet Union collapsed to begin with. That's why Ukraine gave up its inventory of nuclear weapons that remained in country when the USSR collapsed, right? And then everybody went on their merry way because, you know, it was the happy decade of the 90s and Russia was busy doing other things and we got involved, you know, with the war on terror for 20 years and all that sort of things, right? And so, you know, what Zelensky is saying, if we don't want Russia to be the dominant military influence in Europe, then we collectively, we meaning Europe, need to do something about this. And so either Ukraine develops its own, you know, redevelops its own nuclear weapons capability, that would not be a good thing, or, you know, heavy weapon sales or something. But clearly, if you're hanging out there by yourself, individual countries, Putin will take advantage of that. So this idea of collective security, I mean, that's been, you know, the winning formula for NATO for decades, you know, joining in with other people. So, yes, a NATO-like arrangement, but joining NATO is certainly, you know, not going to be accepted by Vladimir Putin. And so Zelensky's trying to figure out some way to bring this this awful period to an end.
But if it's just NATO by another name, then how does Putin react any differently?
Well, I mean, it's wordplay, right? I mean, this is, you know, an era of geostrategic, diplomatic, you know, dancing that goes along. I mean, why is it okay to provide Ukraine an anti-aircraft missile but not provide them aircraft when the whole intent is to shoot down Russian airplanes, right? So, you know, NATO has been a burr under Putin's saddle as long as he's been, you know, ruling Russia. He is angry that NATO continued to expand when part of that assurances dialogue in the early 90s said that NATO would not expand further east. And so he feels encircled. You know, whether we agree with Putin or not, clearly, if he has a view and it motivates his decisions and those decisions result in the death of innocents in neighboring countries, then we have to understand what his motivations might be and account for that in some way. And so that's what Zelensky is doing.
Do you think President Zelensky advocating for his country on every platform possible is helpful at this point, or is Putin seeing that, you know, as him trying to kick the bear?
Well, no, I mean, you know, he is the advocate for his country, right? And so you're going to try to find any venue, any audience, different messages to different audiences. I agreed with you. You mentioned it was kind of a sinister sounding, translator there. Very, you know, dramatic and menacing and all that. You know, maybe that guy was picked because of the arts orientation of the Grammys, musicians and drama and all that sort of stuff. You know, could be. So, you know, I mean, I work in D.C. The reason countries have embassies here, those ambassadors and their staff, it's all about networking. You want to get more people, you know, on your side and try to get support from the United States and from other countries. And so as the head of state for Ukraine, this is what Zelensky is doing. Now, he's going to seek any opportunity. But on the U.S. side, you know, why would you invite him to give a presentation? You know, why would the Grammys do this? And so it's kind of this cool trend now. And I agree with the skepticism. You know, give me a break. I mean, these are news stories. There's a humanitarian crisis and all that. But, you know, speaking in front of, you know, the Oscars, the Grammys, or the, you know, any other kind of award show or something like that, you know, on the receiving end, you know, the NBA, right, or the NFL, why would they do that? But, you know, they're playing into that game. And so I do think that it's kind of gotten silly in those circumstances without, you know, the actual war being an absolute crisis. And it just, you know, the deaths of these civilians on the outskirts of Kyiv that they're finding now, and, you know, bombing of people in shelters and shooting up buses with children in and those sorts of things. I mean, we can't forget, you know, what that implies about the nature of Putin's control of military power in Russia. But when we start getting into all these other war shows and stuff, yeah, I think it's getting kind of a little too loose there.
And of course, I'm all for ending the carnage. But, yeah, you know, with respect to some sort of arrangement, I mean, it's not just the Budapest Agreement that was violated. It's also the Minsk Accords between Ukraine and Russia that was arguably violated by both sides. And that was just 6 years ago. So why would another accord with some sort of, you know, non-NATO language, but essentially the same dynamic, why would Putin be willing to come to the table and accept something like this rather than just dig in as previous mm-hmm. Russian dictators have? And you can continue to kill Russian soldiers. I got more.
Well, you know, you want to explore all the options. I mean, you know, if you don't have some kind of dialogue or diplomatic sit down or some kind of agreement, even if it looks pretty thin, as you've been explaining here, what's the alternative? You know, pummeling somebody into submission. So I don't know that Ukraine is going the offensive into Russia. Everybody's quite concerned about this going nuclear in a very literal sense. What are Putin's objectives? Is he actually going to leave the areas of Ukraine he's already seized? You know, how do you define victory or a win or an acceptable settlement in some way? So I think these various initiatives to try to find some kind of off ramp, it's not an overused word, but, you know, some way to kind of bring the killing to an end. You know, I think all of those are good. What those conditions are completely tied to the context of the moment. You know, where the Ukrainians would want the Russians completely out of the Donbass, to hand Crimea back over. That's what they would like in an ideal world. I don't know that they'll ever get there. And so it's one of these really sad things about war, that once they've been invaded, you know, their cities are in ruin and their civilians, you know, their people are dead. You can't bounce back from that, right, in short order. And so, in the context of the moment, they're going to have to figure out how much pain is too pain and what do they accept or find acceptable just to get the killing to stop.
One of the arguments that's being advanced now by Garry Kasparov in the pages of The Wall Street Journal, by Hillary Clinton on Meet the Press over the weekend is, Russia needs to be considered a pariah state as long as Putin is there, that regardless of whether or not there is some cessation of the violence, mm-hmm. that Putin needs to be treated like Kim Jong-un, like, well, I would say the Ayatollahs, but the mullahs in Iran are not being treated like that based on this nuclear sure. deal. And so the thing to me seems confusing and probably to Putin seems like a lack of seriousness. On the one hand, we're going to make you a pariah state. On the other hand, I'm at the negotiating table with the Iran nuclear deal, and I have a backup from the Chinese communists and Orban in Hungary and Brazil, and I have other places where I can sell my wares and continue to prosecute this war. And even if it's a temporary break in the violence, I'll stop until I can start again.
Yeah, well, it's because nobody takes the Biden administration seriously. I mean, I've friends, colleagues in Europe and in the Asia Pacific, and you know, we're always asking them, hey, you know, what is the external perspective of the United States? And the perspective is this: when Biden went over to talk to NATO leaders and those sorts of things, the reception was so nice of you to show up. You know, here's your chair. We're going to give you, you know, deference and listen to what you have to say, which is completely different than saying, we are so glad you're here, you know, about time, and please help us solve this problem, right? So there's just the view of the United States in this administration is a lack of coherence, seriousness, competency, you know, any kind of effectiveness. So I am not surprised to hear these different messages, you know, from the Democratic Party in particular, you know, pariah, but we want to have discussions with you. Putin, evil guy, yet it's Putin's guy who is representing to the United States in these discussions with Iran on the nuclear deal, right? So how can you try to get a nuclear deal and the Russian is sitting in the meeting for you, and yet we're bashing them and Putin's calling, Biden's calling Putin, you know, a criminal and a thug and just, you know, all the insults that he can bring to bear at the podium, right? So I just don't see any coherence in the Biden administration's foreign policy, and that creates these sorts of problems.
He is Dakota Wood. He served America for 2 decades in the Marine Corps. He's a senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota Wood, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our Turnkey Pro Answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Fox News recently announced the hiring of Caitlyn Jenner to be a Fox News contributor.
That's great.
Why?
I love what she has to say, especially about he or she, whatever, about Title IX and transgender women in sports. I support what she says.
Hmm.
I don't know how often they're going to use her, but she, you know, she, remember, you know, she was a Republican gubernatorial candidate for California. And
yeah. Uh-huh.
She's a Republican.
Yeah, yeah. Fox News CEO Suzanne Scott, per the announcement of Caitlyn Jenner's hiring, Caitlyn's story is an inspiration to us all. It is? How? She is a trailblazer in the LGBTQ plus community, and her illustrious career spans a variety of fields that will be a tremendous asset for our audience. You know, I heard a lot from Jenner since he started identifying as a she. I mean, I find Jenner and his commentary positively anodyne and lacking in insight. But I mean, I guess you could say the same. I would say the same about many Fox News contributors. So that doesn't, that's not, that characterization isn't limited to Jenner, but it certainly includes Jenner. So what's the great value add here? Isn't this just cheap identitarianism and quota-ing by Fox News? And what happens when we start from the premises of the left? Don't we advance their conclusions? For more on this, somebody who agrees with you and disagrees with me, Brad Palumbo, policy correspondent for FEE, Foundation for Economic Education, contributor to the Washington Examiner and co-founder of Based Politics. Brad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning.
Caitlyn Jenner is an inspiration to us all. Well, Suzanne Scott doesn't speak for me, but regardless, what is the value add for a Caitlyn Jenner as a Fox News contributor?
Well, so I certainly think that language is a little bit over the top. But what I would say about the Fox News contributorship is that Fox News, yes, it leans right and its opinion hosts are more conservative, but it's fundamentally a news network. Their contributor roster includes Democrats, like until recently, former DNC chair Donna Brazile. Right. So a lot of people on the right were just angry at the very idea Fox would hire a transgender person, frankly. And to me, that doesn't make any sense because they're not just hiring conservative people. They're hiring people across all the spectrums. And, you know, whatever you think of related issues, there are about a million people, adults, who identify as transgender in the U.S. So it made sense to me that at least one of them would be represented on air. And Caitlyn Jenner, as far as transgender people go, is about as sensible and conservative as and Republican as you can find.
Well, that's what that's sort of my point, though. You're making my point for me. You know, there's a million transgender people in the country, so we need one on the news channel. Well, that's how many Scientologists does Fox News need to hire? I mean, why are we checking boxes based on your identitarian characteristics? How many blacks, how many Hispanics? Does it need to be reflective of the distribution in the population at large?
Well, I think there's something to be said for that going too far and becoming tokenist and extreme. But there's also, I think, this is something where I've kind of come to see a little bit of the point over the years. There's something to be said for representation and people with different experiences, right? Because to be transgender is not just, you know, a box that you check. You experience your life a very different way. And transgender issues are making the news all the time, whether it's Leah Thomas and transgender inclusion in sports and in fairness to women in women's sports. Who can speak to that better than Caitlyn Jenner, former Olympian and transgender person who acknowledges that men have a biological advantage in women's sports, and so they need to be separate. So I actually think there is some unique value add there.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the difference, I suppose you talk about, you know, people from across the political spectrum, the Donna Brazils or the Juan Williamses or back in the day, the Alan Combs. I mean, that's a little bit different because that's somebody who is like, we want a point counterpoint. What they're presenting Caitlyn Jenner as and what Jenner is presenting himself as is some kind of conservative. And I think there's conservatives who find that objectionable for all kinds of obvious reasons, because the perspective is, among many, myself included, that if Caitlyn Jenner is authentic, that he has a case of gender dysphoria.
Right, but I don't see why somebody, even if that's one issue where that person differs from traditional conservatives, Caitlyn Jenner says that she's a constitutional conservative, supports the First Amendment, Second Amendment, capitalism, opposes socialism, opposes far left. I mean, I don't see why a person can't, nobody is 100% anything, really. Life is more complicated than that. So I think Caitlyn Jenner can claim to be a conservative person in many ways, even if on one important issue, Caitlyn has a very different perspective. But also that's part of the diversity there, too, is like Fox has plenty of traditional Christian conservatives, as they should, and they can have a conversation on air about this, hash it out, right, about gender, about what the left thinks, what the right thinks, why some people disagree. I mean, I see that all as a positive.
And maybe at some point in time, they'll ask her, you know, you're a transgender conservative. Why are you transitioning? What happened? I mean, maybe they'll even ask her about her gender dysphoria.
I think they should.
I think that they should, too.
Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, I think that when you elevate somebody to a contributor status and you make a statement like Suzanne Scott made, I think there's, you know, more at play than some sort of expanding the parameters of debate, which are about the width of the eye of a needle on cable news writ large, which is why I don't watch it unless I'm, you know, forced to at gunpoint. But all right, let's tackle a couple of other topics, too. Mark Penn, former Hillary Clinton pollster, had an interesting piece at Fox News website, of all places, where he talked about the five issues that the Biden administration Democrats need to pivot where they're going to get destroyed come the midterms. And it may be too late for them to avoid that. But regardless, one of them, immigration. And we've just had Joe Biden, the administration, announce that they're ending Title 42, the COVID protocol with respect to illegal crossings. It looks like they're going to double down, and Joe Biden's going to try and beat his personal best of 2 million illegal crossings last fiscal year for this fiscal year.
Yeah, look, I think it's pretty nuts. They've got to make up their mind, right? Is COVID over or is it not? Because they're still pushing for all sorts of mask mandates, federal transportation requirements. You've still got New York City masking toddlers, which should never, ever have been a requirement, even in day one. So it seems to me very incoherent and all over the place, this kind of picking and choosing which restrictions to end. And as far as the border is concerned, I mean, it seems like a real tone-deaf move politically to be doing this right now.
And with respect to that issue continuing to be front and center, or at least I think at least some Republicans, including Trump, as he's touring the country doing his rallies again, going to make this an issue. This seems to be, you know, a glide path for Trump in not just in 22, but obviously with an eye towards 24. And one wonders if, to some extent, the Democrats aren't angling for Trump to run in 2024 by, you know, it's a twofer. One, this is what they actually believe, so many of them, in open borders. And two is they know that Trump is going to make that an issue in a way that maybe some Republicans will be reticent to do so. And they wouldn't mind seeing Trump in 24.
Well, he's got so much baggage. You know, he's got just mountains of baggage at this point that I think if they could pick their 2024 opponent, it certainly would be Donald Trump. In my opinion, that's all the more reason that Republicans should maybe be second guessing that and encouraging him to take a little bit more of a backseat role. Because, I mean, this is always the case with a former president or with a former nominee where there's mountains of baggage, where someone like DeSantis just doesn't have January 6th hanging over them or have a bunch of the controversies from the Trump presidency hanging over them. It's more of a clean slate, and I think that's a lot more threatening to Democrats, and Republicans should keep that in mind.
With respect to the Biden administration, Ron Klein, the chief of staff, was on with Clinton Foundation donor Zero over the weekend, and Georgie asked him about the Hunter Biden situation. Didn't ask him about the big guy directly because didn't want to put him on the spot, of course. But this is what Ron Klain had to say about Hunter Biden and whether, you know, Hunter's dealings implicate this White House.
Neither the president or any of us at the White House have had any contact with the Justice Department about that.
Is the president confident Hunter Biden didn't break the law?
Of course the president's confident that his son didn't break the law. But most importantly, as I said, that's a matter that's going to be decided by the Justice Department, by the legal process. It's something that no one at the White House has involvement in.
The Washington Post also reported this week on deals that Hunter Biden had with a Chinese energy company, paid $4.8 million to entities controlled by Hunter and the president's brother. Is the president confident his family didn't cross any ethical lines?
George, the president is confident that his family did the right thing. But again, I want to just be really clear. These are actions by Hunter and his brother. They're private matters. They don't involve the president. And they certainly are something that no one at the White House is involved in.
You think those words are going to come back to haunt Ron Klain and the Biden administration?
Well, they might. And I would just say, like, look, I don't know, and neither do they. All I know at this point is that clearly this story was not Russian disinformation, like we were told. And clearly it shouldn't have been blocked across the board by social media. I mean, these people have egg on their faces. Even the Washington Post just admitted how terribly they botched this. And when the mainstream media is coming out and issuing mea culpas, you know the mistake was bad, because normally they just deny it and move on. So I would not be making firm statements like that in this administration, because I really don't know how it's going to pan out, and neither do they.
What do you think about the timing of this? So of all these news, you know, publications now admitting, oh, yeah, Hunter Biden's laptop does have nefarious things on it. I mean, NBC Nightly News finally did the story. They did it in their D block, but they actually did the story.
It screams damage control to me. And I honestly, you know, setting aside the morality of it, their tactic worked. They wanted to make this not an issue in the 2020 election, so they dismissed it as disinformation and banned it. But the truth came out eventually, but it came out a little too late for this election. So now it's like, I think they're doing this now because the idea is that by the time the midterms roll around, it will have faded, which frankly is probably correct. As cynical as that all is, I think it may actually be shrewd.
Although, again, it seems like this is an issue that Trump picks up and runs with, as he did a little bit in Michigan over the weekend, which is to say, if the Justice Department doesn't pursue this with all the information that's out there, with the D.C. press corps now admitting things that they had denied to protect Biden in the run up to the 2020 election, that this is, you know, fodder for Trump to say, you have a Justice Department for all the things that they said about me and my Justice Department. What you really have is a Justice Department that's serving as the in-house counsel for the Biden Inc. operation. And you should have no faith in the Justice Department. And if you don't have faith in the Justice Department, then you can't have faith in the federal government. And that's not a good place for America to be.
No, it's not. And I think that might resonate with Trump's base. But honestly, I'd be skeptical how much of the, you know, independents or loosely attached political people will really get fired up over that, when I think inflation and the economy and the border and lingering COVID restrictions and then the Ukraine crisis, I just imagine that that might not be on top of people's minds by the time the 2022 midterm rolls around.
He is Brad Palumbo, policy correspondent for FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, Leonard Reed's great organization, contributor to the Washington Examiner and co-founder of Based Politics. Brad, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A little programming note from our producer, Justin.
Yeah?
We have been put in the YouTube gulag again for 2 weeks. So
why?
You can't stream us on AM560's YouTube page because of the interview we did last week with John Law talking about his statistical analyses of the 2020 election and the questions that he raised.
Oh, come on.
That's verboten. We might as well. We have to do one of two things. Either have to just go to Rumble altogether, which is where you'll still find clips from the show, the Chicago Morning Answer Rumble account, or we need to get Elon Musk to buy a stake in YouTube like he did in Twitter. 9% stake in Twitter was announced today, and see if he can, you know, stage a hostile takeover of YouTube like maybe he will of Twitter and allow for free thought on that platform. Anyway, go to our Rumble account, Chicago's Morning Answer Rumble account, for clips of the show. But we're the Solson Heensons of the YouTube world at present. All right? So you know. This would get us banned anyway, I'm sure. Our conversation coming up with Jason Hill from DePaul, philosophy professor there. I want to start with John Stewart on his podcast. He recently had a little confab to talk about race. The title of the discussion, The Problem with White People. And this was brought to our attention by Andrew Sullivan, who is center left and sort of got roped into being part of this panel without knowing what the topic was or what who the guest would be, and regrets that he did it. During the discussion, John Stewart called him a racist and an MFer. Andrew Sullivan. This just shows you where things are at. Here's how John Stewart set up his discussion.
Frederick Douglass told white people, the rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. He said that in 1852. And now, 170 years later, suddenly we're like, hey, you seem upset. We're still cool though, right? Did we do something? Black people have given us step-by-step instructions through the centuries. They didn't even do that with the electric slide. By the way, three steps and then you bend. I don't want to get into it. And yet, even after all that, the wealth gap, worse now. Home ownership, worse now. Segregation, worse now. On average, a white high school graduate is wealthier than a black college graduate. Forget about them telling you, even the stark facts don't seem to matter. For however sincerely we want to reckon and listen, the truth is America has always prioritized white comfort over black survival. Black people have had to fight so hard for equality that they've been irreparably set back in the pursuit of equity. And any real attempt to repair a ton of that damage, reparation, sets off white people's "they're coming for our shit" alarm.
Mm-hmm. When Frederick Douglass said that in 1852, it was true, John. Frederick Douglass also said that he was opposed to any system where the state conferred benefits or imposed responsibilities by race. Oh, John Stewart left that part out.
Yeah, he sure did.
Yeah. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jason Hill. He is a professor of philosophy at DePaul University. He's the author of What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. Post-oppression, not according to John Stewart. Jason Hill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, John and Amy. Thank you for having me.
It's worse now than it was in 1852, I understand from John Stewart, Jason.
Well, those people who don't know the difference deserve to find out a very, very hard way. You know, they should really go back and relive those times. This is just, you know, this is just pure malarkey. This is just race baiting by people who really want to create an artificial sense of divisiveness between blacks and whites in this country, when race relations are, you know, seeming to get a little bit better. But as soon as things seem to get a little bit better, they have to create these artificial divides, because that's how you win votes. It's by creating a permanent victim class and an underclass of black people, and creating a managerial overlord class of alleged white supremacists. And the picture is quite stark, and it's very, very upsetting, you know, but that's how the left will get their votes. It's like, and, you know, like this new law that they have called the Crown Act, creating creating a respect for an open world for naturals here, you know, to say this nonsense that black people are being penalized because of their hair texture. It's a stealth move, of course, to usher in reparations. So, yeah, it's very, very unfortunate that this will stylize artificial divisiveness and the rhetoric that is being used is meant to create an artificial divide between the races. That's the way I see it.
It was a nice little turn of a phrase I want you to address. This is sort of equity argument 2.0. Blacks have had to fight so hard for equality that they haven't been able to gain equity. This is the defense that's offered now, specious, a red herring. But the idea that's the basis on which we need reparations and to essentially try to produce equality of outcome, which is what equity means.
Right. Well, there's a serious, as a logician, I have to just make, I'm going to be an old-fashioned philosopher. There's a serious equivocation going on here, you know, between equality and equity, where equality is, in the American sense, is not economic equality, which this country was not founded on, is equality before the law, which the 1964 Civil Rights Act remedied. It brought all blacks full equality before the law. Equity, of course, we know means equal outcomes, right? Equal outcomes from unequal causes. We're not all equal. Whites are not all equal to each other. Blacks are not all equal. We're not equal in intelligence. We're not all equal in athletic prowess. And Dan and Amy were certainly not all equal in values, which our values are responsible for quite often for the outcomes. So how do you redistribute values? You can't. So this idea of equity and conflating it with equality, trading on people's ignorance, that's why we've got, all of us as conservatives, we've got to spell out the difference between equality, which the 64 Civil Rights Act achieved. There are no blacks today who are not equal before the law. And this pernicious, nefarious idea of equality of outcome, that is all outcomes regardless of personal talent, endowment by nature, cultivation of virtues. We're not equally frugal. We're not equally moral. And these are going to affect outcomes. And you can't redistribute those things. So it's a stealth move by the left, sort of try to conflate the two and confuse people's minds and make equity seem like a really good thing. And when you really cash it out, you really have to transgress on the rights of people, individual rights of people, to really achieve a society that's an equitable society, which is socialism, which is what they're after.
But there is some, I mean, I'm just going to push back a little because I met a child who was discriminated against in Illinois schools because he had dreadlocks or corn rolls. And Governor Pritzker signed the bill banning hair discrimination in schools August 2021. I mean, do you agree that there is some hair discrimination out there? Have you studied that at all? I mean, or do you see that it's a bigger social movement?
Well, Amy, I think that schools have, as I've written in this article in The Hill, I think that corporations like schools have a right to set standards of grooming, right? So we're not talking about neatly braided hair and coiffed, naturally textured hair. If in the judgment of an organization or if in the judgment of a school district, but regardless of race, whether it's white children or black children.
In the workplaces, if you're a white guy and you show up looking like one of the Doobie Brothers, you're going to have the same conversation.
Exactly. If you look disheveled, if you look like you need to have a husky comb put through your hair, then the discretionary powers of one's employers or one's supervisors can be applied. I mean, I don't see where this is an issue. I lived in the Deep South since 1985. People came in with afros back then, with jerry curls. It was never an issue, so long as they were neatly groomed and you didn't look like someone who hadn't combed his or her hair for a month. So, this I think is a false herring. I think this really is a move to create in the minds of people that the taste and the sovereignty and the autonomy it's a virtue signaling law of black people are being overstepped. And if we can create in the mind of people that the personal taste and hairstyles of black people are being trod upon, then we sort of make it easier to pass these reparations laws, which are making their way through California, and certainly H.R. 40 is making its way through Congress. Because people can say, see, black people are discriminated by their hair texture and their hairstyles, so what makes you think that they're not deserving of reparations if their economic wealth, well-being? It's not a stupid law. It's a well-thought-out, stealth, and incrementalist law that the left has crafted, and it's completely unnecessary.
I want to go back to something you said, too, about the division they're trying to create to generate votes. And I think Josh Mitchell from Georgetown has a nice formulation in response to that, too. And you saw this with the John Stewart piece leading into their discussion. It's not black versus white. It's the right blacks versus the wrong blacks. It's the right whites versus the wrong whites, the right Asians versus the wrong Asians. In his discussion, playing clips from black commentators, there was no Jason Hill. There was no Bob Woodson. There was no Shelby Steele. There was no Glenn Lowry represented. It's the idea that all blacks have this viewpoint, and so that's what's representative. And it seems to me the way to undercut that is to go the direction that Josh Mitchell suggests, which is to lay out for people what they're actually doing. Donald Trump is the wrong white person. Joe Biden's the right white person, and so on and so forth.
Well, I think so. Best of luck, because I have to say, Dan, that, you know, even among conservatives, I've been told to sort of sometimes tone down my rhetoric and to be less inflammatory and less incendiary. So I think this is the truth that we just got to lay out the positions and say and show a multiplicity and a divergent viewpoints among conservatives that we're not a monolithic group and that we have our own viewpoints. But I think sometimes conservatives just take a handful of dissenting viewpoints, and where the left will make, you know, stars out of mediocrities like Abraham Kendi,
yes,
and Nicole Hannah-Jones. I think conservatives are less warriors, David. They're less combative, as strange as that might sound.
And I think that's right. Well, so when you say you've been told by conservatives to, you know, tone down your rhetoric, give us more flavor on that conversation. For what purpose?
Well, just like with my last book, there's not one major magazine that has not one conservative, and I mean, I've been on about 50 podcasts, smaller podcasts, but not one major magazine has reviewed the book, and, you know, I've inquired why. It's like, well, there's some, you know, you call black studies in the 1960s, you said that it's populated by a bunch of race hustlers. And I said, well, they are race hustlers. Just them are literate fish pimps. And they're afraid of that sort of language. Whereas when Ibram Kendi will call, you know, white people racist and say it's not just enough to be racist, you have to be an anti-racist. And Nicole Hannah-Jones indict most of America as being complicit in continuing the residual effects of racism. She gets all kinds of prizes. So that's one example where editors will write to me and say, we really like your book, but can you go a little bit softer? I'm serious. This is really heartbreaking. And so refuse to review the book. Thank God for podcasters and shows like yours, where I get to sort of advance my views.
I think you're right that that there is not the same warrior spirit with respect to the beliefs you say you hold among many conservatives that there are on the left. I mean, could you imagine a podcast from any direction that said the problem with black people, the way that John Stewart did a half an hour on the problem with white people?
Right. But yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think that's going to be a pushback. I mean, I think with like the trans issue in athletic sports, I think we're going to see a serious pushback, and I think we're going to see more coverage, and it's not going to come from within the conservative establishment. It's going to come from like conservative parents and commonsensical people who are just sick and tired of being cowed and bullied by these left-wing activists. And that's where the pushback is going to come from. And it's going to be sort of like an organic uprising. I think I've seen it. And I think what we're going to see, for example, is a lot of girls, young women, just boycotting these sporting events or suing the hell out of these trans women. And I think, you know, through events like that, we'll see more coverage and a more fighting spirit coming out of the conservative movement.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, right now, on that issue, we saw over the weekend a story out of the UK that a women's cyclist organization said, we're not participating if you're going to allow men to compete as women in this in these cycling races. And so, I mean, that, you know, which is consistent with some of the pushback you saw with Leah Thomas in the Ivy League.
That's right.
He is Jason Hill. He's a philosophy professor at DePaul. He's also the author of What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. Professor Hill, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning. Excuse me. That is. Oh, hello.
Peter Brady.
That croissant went down the wrong pipe there. Yes, and I'm man enough to eat a croissant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Comfortable enough with my sexuality. Jen Psaki, we hardly knew ye. Actually, we knew ye too well back when she did that Cagney and Lacey routine at the State Department with Marie Harf, now on Fox News. Remember her? Remember that?
I remember
those
that.
Two? Yeah.
Those two little goofballs. Yeah.
Well, now the report is that Psaki, I got to get those in while they're still current, is preparing to leave the White House to go to MSNBC for a gig.
Well, there's a bidding war, at least there was, and
of course
still might be, between MSNBC and CNN.
Well,
so
lest you be concerned that there's any ethical problem with her negotiating with one of the networks that covers the White House, you know, like they're in the tank for her or she's in the tank for them. Don't worry your pretty little heads, because
is it ethical for you to continue conducting this job while negotiating with the media?
Well, I have always gone over and above the stringent ethical and legal requirements of the Biden administration, and I take that very seriously. And as a standard for every employee of the White House, I have received rigorous ethics counseling, including as it relates to any future employment. I've complied with all ethics requirements and gone beyond and taken steps to recuse myself from decisions as appropriate. And so I hope that all of you, I've been working with all of you some time, would judge me for my record.
Well, that's how we'll judge you, no question. She is adhering to the same strict ethical guidelines that the big guy does. So that's good enough for me.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. But you can't press a spokesperson while you're deciding what, you know, your next career is going to be, which media outlet, which is left leaning. I mean, can you imagine if this, you know, shoes returned and what's his name? Oh my God,
Kaylee McEnany or
Sarah Huckabee. Yeah. I mean, we knew Kaylee was eventually going to go back to TV because that's where she started anyway. But she wasn't debating, you know, between Fox News and Newsmax while she was still spokesperson at the White House.
Well,
I mean, can you imagine if the roles were reversed?
Well, here's the thing. You can serve two masters when there's only really one master, can't you?
What do you mean?
It assumes two masters. It assumes that the D.C. press corps outlets are separate and distinct from government, and they're not. The D.C. press corps is the comm shop for government. In fact, the D.C. press corps is the big government press corps. It really is state-run media. And by the way, I would apply that same description to the Trump or George W. Flax on Fox as well. And it's why the parameters of political discourse, as I said before when we were talking to Brad Palumbo from Fee, it's why the parameters of political discourse are the width of the eye of the needle, the eye of a needle. because they're all there to flack for the establishment position on the left or the right, in quotation marks, that they have, or the previous master they served. If there's no if there's no real separation from government and media, if one is doing the bidding of the other, then there's only one master, isn't there? So where's the ethical? The ethical problem isn't with the individual flacks. The ethical problem is with the institution. The Fourth Estate has folded into the state. Don't you think?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, I mean, there's different roles for different people, and of course, this is going to go down. But
why do you see the growth of government go unabated, regardless of who's in power? Where is principled position against a policy, whether it's a policy pursued by the left or the so-called right? Do you see that very often on Fox News? Just to take an example that's more closely affiliated with our side, I don't, which is why I don't watch Fox News. I watch individual interviews on the interweb and things like that, but could you imagine watching Fox News all day?
I couldn't. I watch a few hours here, then I watch CNN. I cannot watch MSNBC, though.
It's all different shades of the same Dane Bramage that it begets. I mean, it really is. There's not how many people on Fox News do you see? And I'm including hosts, not just their canned circle of contributors, which are mostly institutional flacks. How much interesting information do you get from Fox as compared to, reading more in-depth online periodicals or, heavens to Betsy, books?
Does anybody read books anymore?
I just don't get it. And so the whole, ethical guidelines charade that Psaki is engaged in, and the box checking that the D.C. press corps did by pretending that they have real concerns about these lines that don't exist, that's just all political theater. Speaking of political theater, this one more piece from the D.C. press corps. This this characterization of the victimizers as the victims. We talked a little bit about that in the context of identitarian politics. Speaking of MSNBC, this piece over the weekend about how female journalists are being brutalized online. And among those that shared their sob story is a reporter from the Washington Post named Taylor Lorenz, a columnist, really, as if there's such a thing as a reporter. Listen to Taylor Lorenz tell her tale of woe, and then I'll remind you who she is.
Every single social tie, I had severe PTSD from this. I contemplated suicide. It got really bad. Mm-hmm. You feel like any little piece of information that gets out on you will be used by the worst people on the internet to destroy your life. And it's so isolating.
And terrifying.
It's horrifying. I'm so sorry.
You're fine.
Overwhelming. It's really hard.
Have any empathy for Taylor Lorenz?
Get a hold of yourself, woman.
She contemplated suicide. It's just horrifying what happens. The worst people on the internet are out there destroying lives. You know who the worst people on the internet are?
Lefties.
People who operate under the title journalist.
Yeah.
Taylor Lorenz, for those of you who don't recall, just to give you one example of her work, she is the reporter who falsely accused the venture capitalist Marc Andreessen, who, founded Netscape and then went on to Andreessen Horowitz and is a tech venture capitalist. She falsely accused him of using the R slur at a symposium. Never said it. And that's a cancellation eligible crime in the according to the press corps, as well as in the field in which Andreessen operates, big tech.
What's the R slur? I'll find out somehow.
For somebody that's slow.
Okay. Oh.
Or disabled.
And it never happened.
Didn't happen. Okay. Did Taylor Lorenz apologize? No. She didn't apologize.
Well, she should.
What these journalists should do and what they do. So now the worst people on the internet, because she gets threats or she gets, you know, profane missives directed her way, you know, bringing her to a puddle of tears. I mean, I don't agree with threatening people, and I don't agree with the name calling on the order she described in this interview, if that did occur. But she's hardly the only one. Hardly the only one. And she's a good example of someone who traffics in making accusations that are, because of the world she's helped create, cancellation eligible crimes. And now I'm supposed to feel sorry for her, like these leftist journalists that have spewed all this hate and created this these dystopian spaces on the internet. Are the victims? I don't think so. Don't think so. Sorry. Mike in Schaumburg.
Good morning. Yeah, when I was in journalism school, they taught us you had to have thick skin. Otherwise, get out of the profession. Don't bother. You know, you're going to get up against some rough characters, and you have to be able to take it, period.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.